From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the angelic realm. What happens over there? Here's what's happening. Well, as I reported last night, 14 people have died so far from the Ebola outbreak that began earlier this month in Western Uganda. According to the World Health Organization, the first case is believed to be from a village there. So far, 36 suspected cases have been reported. The World Health Organization says that 9 of the deaths are reported to have occurred in just one household. The health official who was treating one of the patients also died. Unfortunately, family members and health officials, those caring for the already sickened, are the most likely to be infected as well. In a moment, we will talk about Ebola because there's a possibility it could come to the United States. Scientists in the United States have identified a new strain of influenza in seals that could potentially impact human and animal health. It's called the H3N8 flu. It's been associated with the deaths of harbor seals in New England last year. Now, researchers say the virus may have evolved from a type that had been circulating in birds. India's power supply has now been fully restored after a two-day blackout across much of the country. More than 600 million people were affected by the power cut after three electricity grids collapsed. Outages caused havoc throughout entire cities being plunged into darkness. Mitch Batras, earthchangesmedia.com. Just a sign of the times, Mitch. You know, when I looked at the story, I said, that's only in one country. What happens when a solar flare hits the planet? And here we are. Look at this.
Well, that's a good observation, George, and I've said before, and actually mentioned in my second book, that really, with such a thing as power outages, especially related to the sun. However, I will say that I do not believe India's power outage is directly related to the sun. It's indirectly related in that just as we are here, they're going through a heat wave as well.
Yeah.
And their infrastructure, as bad as the United States is, India's just much, much worse. Here's the good news for India and other third world countries, which I think are going to do a lot better than we will. One-third of India's households do not have electricity. They don't even have enough power to light a light bulb. The remainder of the two-thirds, 620 million people plus, they are used to, they're familiar with frequent blackouts. Many homes, residents, as well as, of course, businesses, have generators. And so they have experienced this over the years. They won't go through a shock and bewilderment like we will. And I do believe it's coming, George, and I have a feeling it could come this year. That's really more of an intuitive feeling than the science. I don't have the scientific backing to come right out and say it's going to happen this year. I think the setup is that it will. I'm just now, as a matter of fact, tomorrow I have breaking news on new research on the Earth's core and its relation to the Earth's magnetic field. This latest research that just came out is identifying that factually, scientifically, the Earth's magnetic field is lessening. Now, here's what's interesting about that, George, and then I'll get right back to it, is the cause, partly, is earthquakes, submarine volcanoes, and specifically subduction zones. When these subduction zones, when part of the Earth goes, the crust goes into the mantle, it causes cooling. Now, here's what happens. The Earth's core automatically compensates for that cooling by sending more heat. And that flux is what's causing the magnetic field to lessen.
Okay, Mitch, we're going to watch your website, earthchangesmedia.com, for those updates. But like I said, power now fully restored back in India. However, after a couple days, 600 million people plunged into darkness there. Celebrated writer and political commentator Gore Vidal has died, age 86. Vidal died at his home in Los Angeles of complications from pneumonia. He has produced 25 novels, including the best-selling Myra Breckinridge, more than 200 essays, several plays. I met him several months ago in Los Angeles. He was delightful. He was singing at a piano player, you know, and just having a great time. Gore Vidal, dead at the age of 86. A story that you'll find at coasttocoastam.com. They have archaeologists unearthing extraordinary human sculptures in Turkey. The head and torso of a human figure, intact just above the waist, stands about 5 feet tall. It's an amazing sculpture indeed. Now, remember the UFO that motorists spotted along D.C. highways back in June? We got calls from a number of people. The saucer-shaped object caused a stir in the area, prompting many to call 911 and to post photos on Twitter. Well, we later learned the mysterious object was an experimental unmanned aircraft called the X-47B, and the Air Force has now admitted, yep, that's what it was. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, you know, I've been saying for some time now that I think a lot of UFO cases that people are seeing are objects, are drones that they might have experienced and experimented with years gone back. What do you think?
Well, that's quite possible, George. If they're being towed on the highway on a trailer behind an Air Force vehicle, I would tend to agree with you. But the unmanned aerial vehicles, the so-called drones, are a fairly recent development. And, of course, we've been getting UFO reports for the last 37 years on the hotline, and they've been around for a long, long time. I don't think many people would mistake a UAV for a UFO, but who knows? It's quite possible. I was just reading the account of the X-47B on Wikipedia. For members of the audience who'd like to know more about it, they have a very good analysis of it. And what is most interesting to me is they're proposing that the next variation is going to be, of course, the X-47C, the Charlie model, and it's going to be about three times the wingspan of the X-47B. You got to wonder what the world's going to be like when we have all these drones buzzing around our heads with no pilots, no crew aboard. There could be some excitement on this planet.
You're going to be flooded at the National UFO Reporting Center. That's what's going to happen, Peter.
Could be. I think most people are smart and experienced enough to recognize that one of these things is not an alien spacecraft. But I'll tell you, the last couple of months, I have seen more UFO reports each month than I've seen over the last 17 years, George. Typically, we've received about 250 reports per month. In June of this year, we had 974, and in the month of July, about 1,100 already.
All right, what's new at the UFOcenter.com?
What's new here, you say?
Yes, sir.
These reports of red and orange and yellow fireballs continue to pour in here. We talked about this the last time I was on Coast, and the phenomenon, George, is actually accelerating. I have no idea what these things are. I don't think anybody else does, and MUFON and the National UFO Reporting Center have finally agreed that this is a very unusual phenomenon. And I just published an article in the most recent issue of the UFO Journal, the monthly publication by MUFON. People can read what I have to say in that article if they can get their hands on a copy of it.
Great. Thanks, Peter. Peter Davenport, his website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, we're going to talk about Ebola with Dr. Charles Simone and also how to save yourself from a terrorist attack. All that is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Ebola, the virus first detected in 1976 in Central Africa. What are the symptoms? Well, high fever, joint, muscle pain, sore throat. But Ebola victims often get bloody, followed by rashes, red eyes. And there is apparently no treatment for Ebola, no vaccine. Dr. Charles Simone is one of the few individuals in the world with formal training in medical oncology, radiation oncology, and immunology, with expertise in nutrition, cancer prevention, and detection. As one of the first physicians to champion integrative medicine, Dr. Simone combines effective conventional with alternative medicine, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Charles, welcome. How are you?
Thank you.
My pleasure indeed. Ebola, there is some fear, even though there's 14 people who have died in Uganda, 36 cases. There is some fear that it possibly could spread maybe even to the United States. How possible, Charles, is that?
I don't think it's very possible. What we've seen a couple cases that come from the Philippines into monkeys that we buy for our research labs, and it stays there in the monkeys, generally not into the human in the United States. We see this disease mainly in pockets of Africa, and the countries involved are just right around the same area all the time, usually. And what we're learning is, as you point out, the symptoms are very common, and they could be very confused with flu-like syndrome. People have this general malaise, fever with chills, pain in the joint, pain in the muscle, chest pain, some nausea, some abdominal pain, very non-specific kinds of things that you have to watch and see what's happening with these people. Respiratory tract problems are usually accompanied by sore throats, cough, shortness of breath, and hiccups. And what we see is generally people with headaches, agitation, confusion, fatigue, and depression, sometimes seizures, and even sometimes coma. Most of these people, about 50% of all these people, have some kind of coagulation problem. They bleed. They bleed mm-hmm. through their orifices.
Rashes. Yeah, they do. They bleed out indeed.
That's right. And this is where electrolyte imbalance occurs, hypotension, cardiovascular problems, and then ultimately death, usually with necrosis of the skin. So it's commonly presented that way, and we see it in pockets. When we see one or two cases, we're bound to see more, generally in areas that have poor hygiene or in hospital settings that have poor recognition of proper isolation techniques. And this is very, very common, in, unhappily, in indigenous areas like this. And what we've learned over the years is probably the main reservoir of this virus, and this, we talk about this in our book, How to Save Yourself from a Terrorist Attack. These are RNA viruses. They're not likely to be biological weapons because you can't weaponize them. You can't aerosol them, put them in the air, and send them to humans. Humans get them only from handling carcasses or dealing with gorillas, monkeys, chimpanzees, that group of animals.
The head of Uganda, Charles, yesterday said, and I don't know if this was just being overly cautious or not, he said, do not shake hands, don't kiss, obviously don't have intercourse with people. But the shaking hands thing is what amazed me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, once you get into the person, then it's person to person. And it goes quickly with people to people, especially people, again, who don't have proper hygiene, don't observe that kind of behavior. So there's no question. Once it's in the human, then it is person to person, not aerosolized, but in fluids, in saliva, in semen, in vaginal lubrication. All those kinds of things will shed the virus, and then the person next to the person will be susceptible that way.
Do these third world nations tackle the problem immediately so it doesn't spread? I mean, 14 dead in Uganda right now, 36 cases. I mean, have they got this thing contained, do you think?
Well, it's hard to know right now. Most of these cases of recent times have been small numbers of people. When it first was discovered in 1976, it was several hundred at a time because no one knew exactly what it was. Now that they've recognized it and now that our people have gone into this country, they will properly use the proper techniques of isolation, hygiene, and that kind of thing. But it's hard to recognize at first, but once it is recognized and our CDC and World Health Organization people are organized and brought in, then the death rate goes down. For instance, in 1976, when it was first diagnosed, 284 people were diagnosed with it in one location, and about 53% of them died. As the years went on, lesser numbers became infected and lesser percentages have died from it. Except in Zaire, there was a big outbreak there in 1995. But once you recognize the pocket, you can contain it pretty much once you bring in the right kind of people and observe the right hygiene.
Will a strong immune system fight it?
That's the critical thing. If you have a strong immune system, you will be able to fight it. If you have simple vitamins and minerals, will help this a great deal. Beta carotene, vitamin E, vitamin C, those antioxidants, those immune system enhancing agents, together with the B vitamins, will help a great deal to enhance a person's immune system. Together with simple hand washing, facial washing, and keeping generally clean in general.
That's amazing. Okay, we're going to keep watching that story. Charles, I'm going to talk with you about your work, how to save yourself from a terrorist attack when we come back from the break. But I want to take a few moments now, just to, because you're an expert in immunology. This flesh-eating bacteria that has claimed lives, that has claimed, you know, parts of people, this poor girl who, you know, went ziplining, cut her leg, and, you know, now he's got her legs and her hand cut off. What the heck is this thing?
Well, the virus starts to consume and eats the tissue, and the tissue becomes necrotic, dies, and hence anything that touches it can rip it apart. It's very easy to rip away the skin once it becomes, once the skin, integrity of the skin becomes eaten up by the virus.
They can't stop it, it seems.
No, not at all. There's no way to stop it. We have no vaccine. We have no formal treatment. No antibiotics, no antiviral agents have been shown to be effective. So we have nothing to do except isolate and support the patient with the proper fluids and things like that.
If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, like this woman was, this young lady, you know, going into the lake, obviously it was in the lake. It must have been infested with this kind of bacteria. I guess it's not everywhere, is it?
Well, no, and we suspect it's related to bats. You know, bats are a big problem for carrying diseases. They are the most likely candidate to carry this virus. So what bats do, they eat fruit, and their saliva harbors the virus. These bats are not infected, and as they fly around, they drop partially eaten fruit. Now, this partially eaten fruit, with their saliva is infected, it will go into lakes and streams and lands, and then picked up by animals like gorillas and chimpanzees to continue their finishing of that fruit. And hence, that's how these primates get infected, and then that's how it gets transmitted to humans.
Does the bacteria itself multiply?
Yes, the virus multiplies inside the bat, and the bat saliva is laden with this virus.
Are we as human beings winning these battles against these viruses and bacteria, or are we losing?
Well, we're not winning at all. These viruses are very clever. Every 10 to 14 days, they mutate. So they're pretty clever little critters. They mutate and try to survive any way they can. But the key thing is the reservoir. Once you recognize the bat droppings and isolate the animals, then you can pretty much isolate this problem. But you know, there are many types of fruit bats, and some are huge. You've probably seen some of them if you've been to Australia. These bat droppings are everywhere. Not only do gorillas pick them up, but also small antelopes indigenous to certain areas of the sub-Sahara. And that's why we see this kind of thing in these countries, in local areas, and in around the sub-Sahara.
I thought they used to use bat droppings for fertilizer. Do they still do that? Do you know?
Well, the fecal material itself is fertilizer, but it's also laden with the saliva, has the virus with it.
So how do you an unsuspecting person, how do you avoid this?
Well, you and I would not pick up a partially eaten fruit that you find on the ground. Animals will, but you and I would not, and that's the big problem. The gorillas, the chimpanzees, They find this fallen fruit that's an easy pickup, so they wouldn't have to go up on the tree and pick it up themselves. They eat it, and they become infected with it.
I wonder if a homeless person would do that, though. I bet they might.
Yeah, I imagine. But, you know, I think the people in those areas are privy to that knowledge not to do it. But, again, it's never been shown to, although it's not been able to be shown, but it's never been shown to have a direct initiation with a human. It's always from a gorilla, chimpanzee, monkey, and then human.
Is the CDC doing the proper job to inform people about these problems? I've learned more from you in 10 minutes than I have from the CDC in all my life.
Well, I think, you know, the Ebola virus is so uncommon, not even seen in our country in humans, that perhaps they don't need to do anything in our country. But perhaps the world organizations and other organizations like that should be at least much more prominent in these areas that have this indigenous region of this virus dropping.
Amazing.
I think they
stories.
Need to do a better job, yes.
I think so, too. Charles, you have a book out called How to Save Yourself from a Terrorist Attack. I want to talk about that when we come back in just a moment. But very briefly, Give us your website before the break. Would you spell it out for us?
DrSimone.com. DrSimone.com.
Super. More to come when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to ask Dr. Charles Simone a question or two. And we're with Dr. Charles Simone. Charles, you wrote a book, How to Save Yourself from a Terrorist Attack. Tell me about this.
Well, it was printed a week and a half after 9/11. I have been working on it for a long time. And we've known terrorists have been attacking the United States and many other countries for multiple times. And that we've never been actually prepared as individuals. Our government has never informed us what to do in the event an attack came, even though we had been attacked prior to 9/11 multiple times before that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wrote this book. I also wrote it because our service people, our men and women in the armed forces, are given manuals thicker than the telephone book and told to memorize it, read it. This book that I wrote is a pocket-sized book. It's only about 90-some pages, 48 pages, rather. Very large print, very white paper, so if you're in a dimly lit room, you'll be able to find it, see it, read it. And it goes through anything that you can imagine with regard to terrorism attacks, from biological to nuclear to chemical and other things like that. It also gives you a 5-step plan, what to do, how to recognize problems, how to recognize an illness, what to do in a dollar store. You can go out into a dollar store and pretty much buy everything you need to ensure the safety of you and your family.
It's pretty wise, and we've recommended it, that people just stock up on certain items, even if they never even touch them. Just put them away. Is that something you recommend too?
In fact, we do. Step 5 of our plan tells you what to buy, and it's very easy, very inexpensive. Bleach, latex gloves, bandages, petroleum gauze, topical antibiotic, calamine lotion, surgical mask, hydrogen peroxide, baking soda, aspirin. Those are the major necessities for decontamination. For lighting and communications, tea light candles, 15 in a pack for a dollar, oil lamps, batteries, radio, electric generator. Hydration, a water distiller, very inexpensive. Juice drinks, bottled drinks. And food and cooking, as you mentioned, dried fruit, rice, pasta, soup, canned goods, propane tanks, charcoal, Sterno, and on and on like that. It's a whole list, including some medications you should always have on hand, no matter what.
And it doesn't sound very expensive.
It's very, very inexpensive. Very inexpensive to do this. As I said, most of these things you could go and buy at a dollar store anywhere in the country.
You know, we've seen episodes beyond just pure terrorist attacks, the tragedy in Aurora, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
These are episodes, I think, Charles, that will continue to disrupt, you know, America and in the lives of so many people. This particular episode contained to that region. But, you know, it tells you just how easy it is to create havoc and terror in any kind of community, doesn't it?
It doesn't take much. You're right. All you have to do is a little bit of a study what to do, and you can create a lot of havoc, a lot of terror in our country.
What would be beyond just some of the supplies,
mm-hmm.
what would, as a doctor, what are your main concerns about the possibility of some kind of attack one day?
Well, I think the attack possibility is quite real, and we're not prepared for it even now. The first step of this plan is to be alert. We have to watch everyone and make sure that everything looks normal. If it's not, if there's people or events that don't appear to be right, contact authorities. The second step that we already talked about, we need to keep our immune system as to peak performance as much as possible and decrease our risk of infection from a biological attack. We talk about what to do nutritionally, low-fat, high-fiber diet. Certain vitamins and minerals are critical to take in every day. Stop smoking, alcohol less than a couple of drinks a week, walking briskly for 20 minutes. These all enhance your own immune system. If you're doing that, then you're less likely to be susceptible to not only infectious diseases and weaponized aerosol, things like that, but also other things like neurological issues. As long as you're strong, as long as your immune system is strong and healthy, you're going to be able to thwart much of these neurological, biological, and chemical attacks.
I think so, too. You're an expert. You've got incredible expertise in cancer prevention, cancer detection. I have always said to Charles, I came back from a meeting a couple of months ago at the City of Hope in Los Angeles, and I sat down next to a couple of researchers, and they agreed with me that everybody probably has some kind of cancer cell in them. It's that their immune system is able to contain it. Is that something you'd agree with that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, all of us make cancer cells every day, and if it weren't for our immune system being to a good performance, it then will take hold, form a colony, and grow into a detectable cancer years later. It takes about 10 to 15 years or more for a cell or two to become detectable. So what insult we had, say, 15 years ago, we may have forgotten, is what is now going to cause your problem. So our early in life experiences have a lot to do with our future problems, biological, those kinds of things, whether it be cancer, heart disease, whatever we do early in life has a lot to do with what's going to happen to us in the future. That's why we develop the Healthy Start program for children, to teach them early in life what to do, how to stay healthy, so that their immune systems are always strong and they can help decrease the risk of cancer, heart disease in the future.
One of the researchers, when I asked them if they would take chemotherapy if they had cancer, they said, well, right now we would. The goal is not to have to ever do chemotherapy. It's poison.
Well, unhappily, we looked at this since 1920 to the present time. We have made limited progress in the treatment of cancer. And that's despite radiation therapy in the 10s and 20s. That's despite combination chemotherapy in the 60s, despite the war on cancer declared in 1971 by President Nixon. That's despite immunotherapies and then all of our fancy MRI scans, PET scans, all that fancy technology we have. None of that has changed at all the lifespan of a patient with cancer. So a person with prostate cancer or breast cancer today will live no longer than a person who had it in 1920, all the treatments we give them.
And radiation, not only does it kill some of the cancer cells, but it also kills the good cells, doesn't it?
Well, it kills everything in the path of the beam.
In the region, right.
Yeah, and as does chemotherapy, it kills any actively dividing cells. So cancer cells theoretically are actively dividing. That's why they theoretically die. But also that's why people have hair loss or GI nausea and vomiting, because these cells are always rapidly dividing, and that's why the side effects occur with chemo.
A normal cell in a body will live how long before it dies and then gets replaced?
It depends on the organ. Brain cells are there forever. So if you screw up a brain cell, you lose that cell forever. Cardiac muscle can't reproduce. Liver cells can reproduce. So if you injure a liver, you will reproduce many of those cells very quickly.
So if, let's say, through nutrition, you are able to kill off a cancer cell, what are the odds of a good cell growing back in its place?
Oh, very high. In fact, studies have already shown that. The books we've written, Cancer Nutrition, the first of the genre, we've shown that people who decided not to have conventional treatment, no chemotherapy, no radiation, no surgery, when you put those people on extremely low-fat, high-fiber diets, and these are sponsored by government studies, when you put them on those kinds of diets, you can actually change the outcome of their illness without any conventional treatment. So you can take care of yourself even when you have a diagnosis made. These studies were done in breast cancer patients, prostate cancer patients, and also even in colon cancer patients.
What is the controversy, Charles, with mammography? Take it. What's going on there?
That's a $6 billion a year industry, so it's a big money item. And what we have found and what the data show constantly, over and over and over again, that they do not change the outcome, the lifespan of a patient. So you can find a cancer. Let's say cancer of the breast is a 15-year disease. Before mammographies, we found cancers with our hands, manual examination, at around year 11 or 12. So those patients lived 3 years, 4 years of the 15-year disease.
Okay.
With the mammogram, all we have done is simply find the disease earlier in that course of 15 years, say at around year 7. So now the patient seems to live longer than the 3 years, of course, but in actuality, when you look at the life cycle of that disease, they don't. Mammograms don't help us with regard to lifespan. Self-examination of the breast doesn't help us. And the story is very intriguing about this, the breast cancer story with mammograms. The data came to the National Cancer Institute in the late 70s that the people in Canada showed that there was no change in lifespan. And our National Cancer Institute people reviewed it and said, yeah, you're right, but we don't need to, you know, recommend this anymore. They did. The United States Senate said, hey, hold up. We need to recommend this to all our women. And the NCI people, the National Cancer Institute people, presented the data and said, no, there's no reason to. And they had a major conference called the International Conference at the National Institutes of Health. And the data showed that, in fact, there was no support for that yearly mammogram story. Then something called the Sense of the Senate. Sense of the Senate. This is a cute one. Sense of the Senate came out and said, nope, we, the people in the Senate, United States Senate, say mammograms should be done every 1 to 2 years. And that's how that simply has continued with no scientific background for it. In fact, if you look at the data constantly as it comes out every year, the data show the same thing. Mammograms are not very helpful with regard to lifespan. They find the cancer earlier, but that doesn't change the outcome of the life of the patient.
What causes a cancer cell to basically be created? To be
born? Oh, boy, that's the skillion-dollar question, isn't it?
Sure is.
Its major cause, 60% of all women's cancers and 40% of all men's cancers are related to nutritional factors. So a high-fat diet, low fiber, lack of vitamins and minerals will increase the risk of cancer, heart disease. But the cancers involved here are breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, GYN, female cancers. These are all highly sensitive to dietary changes with a high-fat, low-fiber diet and lack of vitamins and minerals. Now, 40% of our people in our country take vitamins, but most of the time, they take an over-the-counter brand, which, I mean, all vitamins are over-the-counter, but they'll take one that's heavily marketed and may have small amounts of vitamins and minerals. Well, most of the time, these vitamins and minerals in low doses may not be the right doses that particular person needs.
Right.
And so that's the problem. So people may be taking vitamins and not watching their diet, thinking the vitamin is going to give them green light to eat the cheesecake and everything else and get away with it. They also need, 30% of cancers are related to tobacco. 20% of cancers are related to 2 or 3 glasses of alcohol per week. So all these three major factors are controllable and all relate to tipping over of a normal cell into a cancer cell.
Now, with regards to the nutrition, what to eat, what not to eat in order to, boost your immune system, mm-hmm. and keep on going, with the vitamins especially as well, my big kick these days, vitamin D. I think it's a wonder vitamin. Am I close here?
It is. It's a fad of the last couple of years. Every few years, we have a new fad in medicine or nutraceuticals, right. And vitamin D is that. In fact, most of our people in our country are deficient in vitamin D because we don't allow the sun to expose have our bodies exposed to the sun. We use sunblocks and things like that. So we are deficient in vitamin D, vitamin D3, that is. The number 3 is important.
D3, right?
Yeah, D3 is important. So if you're going to take a supplement, take vitamin D3, and probably in the order of 2,000 to 5,000 units a day is what you should be doing.
I've been taking a lot of turmeric these days as well. We've done a lot of research with some, experts who've come on the program.
Right.
And it seems like this special spice might be something wonderful.
Well, it's an anti-inflammatory agent. So the major reason why we have chronic diseases is inflammation. So if you can decrease inflammation with an herbal like a turmeric, that's a good thing to do.
How did you begin to mix conventional medicine with alternative?
Huh. Good story. Well, I was at the National Cancer Institute, heavily engrossed in basic science, doing bench research and also clinical oncology. And Vice President Humphrey was referred to me there at the time, and he was dying then not of his cancer, but of malnutrition.
Wow.
I later learned that 40% of all cancer patients today die of malnutrition and dehydration. And that's why this Ebola thing is right up on top, because they die of malnutrition, dehydration, because of all the losses of bodily fluids. In any event, back to the story, I start looking at this whole issue of malnutrition and nutrition and the relationship to cancer. At the time, there was a lot of data in the literature, but the word nutrition was a no-no word at the National Cancer Institute, so I put it on hold. I kept it in the back of my mind. I was doing a lot of basic research in immunology, how white cells killed cancer cells, how something called complement proteins killed other cells, how the killing mechanism occurred. I did mainly killing mechanisms, how it all worked. I started working on things, the J5 antigen, that looked at the anthrax story. So I worked heavily with the armed forces and looked at anthrax vaccines, et cetera. In any event, I tabled the story of nutrition for about a year. Then later, a young man my own age came in with a horrible cancer. He had a young family. His wife was pregnant, and he asked me to be kept alive to see the birth of his son. They knew.
Oh, my.
And I said, well, I'll do what I can. So I gave him lots of chemotherapy. We killed all the tumor cells we could find. All the scans came back normal, but he was still dying nonetheless. At the time, I had no knowledge about vitamins and minerals, and I decided to just give him some vitamins and minerals. And I gave it to him, and he perked right up in about 2 days.
Isn't that amazing?
I didn't believe that as a scientist because, you know, nutrition can't help anybody at that time in the 70s and 80s. So I withdrew the vitamins from him, and he slumped right back down. And I didn't believe that. I thought that was another coincidence. So I gave the vitamins back to him, and he perked right up. Well, it taught me a big lesson. I knew nothing about nutrition. I knew nothing, even less about vitamins and minerals with regard to humans. So I started looking into it. He did see the birth of his son, ultimately. And at that point, I started looking into the research that fomented and brought forth the book, the first of its genre, Cancer and Nutrition.
That's amazing. And are other doctors beginning to get on this bandwagon, this mixture between conventional and alternative, or are they still fighting that?
I think they're still fighting it. You know, in, when the first book came out in 1981, there was plenty of literature for me to write the book. The book was published by McGraw-Hill initially. And even then, doctors give me a hard time. But even now, 30-plus years later, doctors really don't have a grasp of the fact that 60% of cancers for women and 40% of all men's cancers are nutritionally related. 75% of all cardiovascular disease, nutritionally related. So, you know, doctors read their journals like everyday people read magazines and newspapers. They see a title on the article. If they like the title, they'll read the article. If they don't like the title, they'll turn the page. So if you've been brainwashed to believe that nutrition has little to do with diseases, then you'll simply not read articles that are related to it. I can tell you there are hundreds, if not thousands, per month of articles related to diseases, nutrition, vitamins, and things like that. And rarely can I tell you that when patients come to me, they're dumbfounded by the information I give them, even though now it's 35 years old.
What do you think of my theory, Charles, that this planet has the ability to cure any ailment? You just have to find it.
I think that's quite true. You know, Mother Nature is very simple. And if you just look at things in a simplistic fashion, you should be able to find the problem and then come up with a solution for it. There's no question about it.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back, final hour, with Dr. Charles Simone. We will take your phone calls with him as we talk about Ebola, cancer, and other issues, of course. His book, How to Save Yourself from a Terrorist Attack, and his website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back with another hour with Dr. Charles Simone right here on Coast to Coast AM.